Introduce yourself, please.
Ryan Sylvie. I'm the state senator from north of the river in Clay County. Have all of Kansas City within Clay County, plus Liberty, North Kansas City, Gladstone.
Welcome back.
Area. Thanks.
We're glad you're here.
Glad to be here.
Let's get started.
This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. Welcome to the production studio at KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison. We are here with Senator Ryan Sylvie, Republican from Kansas City's Northland, and also with my colleague here at KCUR, Ellie Moxley. Hi, Ellie.
Hey, Brian.
Glad you're here. So we always start by asking about family and pets, and you've told us about those before, Ryan, but any developments since you were last with us in February?
Well, today in studio on the other side of the glass is my youngest daughter, Callie, who has not been to a radio station before. So she's joining us today to see how this whole side of things is done.
How old is Callie?
Callie is 10. She'll be in fifth grade next year.
All right. Well, I hope that the luxury of the surroundings here does not cause her to dream only of going into a career in radio today.
Well, I liked Ryan was saying that, you know, he has been dragging Callie around this summer. She's been appearing with him on events. And I asked her if those were any fun. And she kind of just waved her hand and was like, "Yeah," but she's over on the other side of the glass bouncing up and down. So
yeah, she seemed
maybe we're doing okay.
This would be a cool thing to come to. So,
and I think our producer, Matt Hodapp, may have a real future in babysitting as well. So this is all very good. Ryan, let me ask you about what's going on these days. It's summertime. The session has been over now for, I don't know, 6 weeks or so. How do you keep yourself busy as a state senator during the off season?
You know, it's kind of a transition because you're now home more than you're in the state capitol. My days are a lot of meetings with constituents, meetings in the community, group meetings, that sort of thing, which Callie has come along with me to several of. Really just a lot of that. And then because it's a campaign year, in the evening, knocking on doors, that sort of thing, just trying to meet constituents and kind of get the pulse of the community, really.
And I know it is a campaign year, and we'll maybe talk a little bit about that. You don't have a Republican primary opponent, but you have a Democratic opponent.
Correct.
When you go out and you knock on doors, what are people saying to you these days? What are they talking about?
You know, it's funny because most people, when they open the door and you introduce yourself, are a little off guard. They don't expect an elected official to be at their door. And so a lot of times there aren't any questions right then. They're like, "Oh, I don't know. Let me think." But to the extent that that they do, I mean, a lot of people have questions about what's getting the most attention, right? I mean, we have a presidential election going on. Everybody pays attention to the national scene. So, you know, sometimes people want to talk about that. And, you know, we walk through the fact that I go to Jefferson City, I work on state laws and don't have a lot of influence in that arena. Sometimes they ask about other campaigns because you have all these campaigns with commercials going right now. And, you know, sometimes they'll ask about other candidates.
So basically the same things that we're going to ask you about.
Yeah, probably.
All right.
Probably so.
Well, let me start with Ellie Moxley.
I've been reporting on the Kansas side on elections a lot, and I've actually had the opportunity to go out with several candidates to knock on doors and hear what people are saying. On the Kansas side, it's a lot of schools. I've also been hearing a lot of questions this week about kind of what's going on with gun policy in the state, in Missouri, in Kansas. Where do you think we're sitting right now?
Well, I mean, of course, in Missouri, we're going to have a veto session in September, and the governor's vetoed, among other things, a pretty high-profile piece of gun legislation. So I'm sure that debate will heat up in the coming weeks as we head towards that. I suspect it will probably be overridden just by virtue of the number of votes it had when it passed the first time. But, you know, as far as schools go, we have actually been able to put more money into schools on our side of the state line. And while we're still not fully funding the formula under the statute as it's written, we're getting closer and closer to that and have not ever scaled back.
Do you see anything not being overridden by the legislature?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, this year, I don't recall there being any of the controversial labor issues. You know, those are the ones that typically have a hard time getting overridden.
Partly due to Republicans like yourself who actually have voted with Democrats in sustaining the governor's veto, like on right to work last year.
Right, on labor issues. But when you look at the district that I come from, for instance, I've got the Ford plant in my district where there's 8,000 UAW workers that are right there in the district. And so those are the people that I represent. And that's one of the issues that, party doesn't dictate what we do all the time. And in fact, what happens at home, at least as far as I'm concerned, is going to trump party leadership every time. And that causes some problems in other areas, but it, it's what people deserve to be represented by.
Like what problems does it cause?
Well, I mean, I don't think you'll ever see me being president of the Senate, getting votes from my colleagues to be in leadership, because they don't necessarily feel like I'm the best team player, I guess, all the time on their issues. And so those are the kind of issues. But as far as like getting reelected and talking to the folks back home, I mean, that's what they want of me. So that's more important to me than being in leadership.
Does that apply sort of all the way down the line? I mean, okay, so you may not be president pro tem of the Senate, but what about like committee chairmanships?
Well, I mean, obviously the president pro tem he chooses who the committee chairman are, and that could come into play too. I mean, if he's really angry at me about something,
Were chair of the budget committee in the House when you were a state representative.
I was, and I'm vice chair in the Senate, and the chairman is now term limited. So, my hope is to chair that appropriations committee next year. If the president pro tem decides to pick someone else, that may be one of the reasons that plays into it.
And are you laying odds on your chances to be the appropriations chair?
I'm going to hold out and think the best. Really, when it comes to a term limited environment, there is no one in Jefferson City who's had more appropriations experience than me. And I would hope that trumps any particular vote on any particular issue.
Let's talk a little bit about the session just passed. We've talked a little bit about veto overrides, but as you look back on kind of the accomplishments and or lack of accomplishments of the session, what comes to mind for you? And I want to ask about one in particular, and then maybe you can tell me others you're thinking of. You and I sat here and talked with Ellie about 5.5 months ago about ethics reform, and you in particular had a plan for limits that could be placed on campaign finance contributions.
Right.
No such plan by you or any of your colleagues was
successful.
Was approved.
Right?
Is that a failure on the part of the General Assembly?
I think the people are going to consider it as a failure. We did do some ethics proposals. There are some that the governor signed, but we tried to have that conversation. We tried to have the campaign finance conversation. We tried to have the dark money conversation. The idea that you have 501c4s that raise a bunch of money and then throw them into campaigns, but then hide their books because they're 501c4s. And we tried to have that conversation. But they were ultimately not successful. And, that just means that we will continue having those conversations. So at some point, it will either happen or it will become increasingly uncomfortable for those who keep it from happening.
Yeah.
I'm almost wondering, and we're talking about dark money and we're talking about campaigning. And like you said, so many people, you're knocking on their doors and they want to know about other races and they want to know about the presidential campaign. I mean, I think we have a real potential for this to get even nastier at the national level. Do you think that any of that kind of that's going to go on between now and the next session might actually help move the conversation forward next time?
I think probably the most honest answer I could give is it's going to depend on who wins and who loses and how nasty the campaign was against them. I think if you survive and you come through a season like that, you may be more motivated to try and stop that from happening again in the future. But if the people who are perpetrating those ads and doing those tactics are the ones who end up winning, then there's probably not much hope for change.
And are you a supporter of Donald Trump?
I was a supporter of John Kasich. I was Kasich's Missouri guy.
But that is not the question I asked.
That is not the question you asked, but that is the answer I gave.
But okay, but I mean, as you say, when you go to these doors, you are the local face of the Republican Party for these folks who are voting for you in your district. They must be asking you who you're voting for president.
You know, I've only had one person ask and then immediately said, I'm sorry, I probably shouldn't ask you that. So.
Well, I don't know. Ellie, do you want to be the second person to ask or shall I?
I mean, maybe I'll try asking this way. I think we're starting to finally see some of the platform coming out of what we might see in Cleveland in the coming weeks. What do you kind of think about this real turn to, I feel like, some very social conservative issues, maybe not necessarily even what Trump has been saying? We're hearing Indiana Governor Mike Pence as the VP nod. How do you feel like kind of the party's coming together at this point?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was talking with a couple of my friends yesterday kind of about this issue and you know, the concept of there have been a lot of changes since I first declared myself for office as a Republican. And so I was kind of teasing, you know, one of my friends. I was like, you know, I kind of feel like if I was elected before it was put in the platform, that's on you, not on me. I mean, I was Republican on this platform.
So what are some examples of things that are in the platform now that weren't when you were elected?
Well, I mean, for Missouri, right to work is probably the big one. I mean, that has become the banner waving issue of whether or not you're a good Republican in the state. And that was not, I mean, you go back to 2005 when I was first elected, we had a Republican majority in the House, a Republican majority in the Senate. We had Matt Blunt in the governor's mansion. This issue didn't even come up. Like, if you wanted to do it, that would have been the time to do it. Mm-hmm. But it was the recognition at that time that in order to build a supermajority or even that just maintain a majority at that time, you really had to find issues where you could kind of work with the middle and get some crossover support. And that was one of those issues. Now that we have a supermajority, the new members who have come in because of the constant cycle of term limits, they don't have that history and they forget. And they're walking down a path that will ultimately cost them a supermajority.
Does it matter to you what's in the Republican National Committee's platform?
I mean, not terribly. I mean, just to be honest, as long as the overarching philosophy is there, you know, I mean, the reason that I choose to be a Republican as opposed to being a Democrat is the overarching philosophy of what is the purpose of government in your everyday life. It's not because of this plank of the platform or that plank of the platform. You know, I tend to believe that government should not be and cannot be the solution to every problem, that government ought to empower individuals to better themselves as opposed to provide things for them. Those are the things that make me a Republican. Plank A, B, C, and D, you know, I'll be honest, I haven't even read the platform at the national level.
So if we do take it back to the state level then and talk about accomplishments of the party with regard to those underlying principles, our last guest on the Missouri State House Blend was Representative Daron McGee, a Democrat from Kansas City. Representative McGee said that his explanation for why the Republicans passed, both the House and the Senate on the last couple days of the session passed the Stand Your Ground gun legislation was that they didn't have anything they could really point to as an accomplishment to show their base, and they needed something before the end of the session. I'd be curious to know whether you agree with that assessment, but also his broader point, were there any real gains for the supermajority Republican leadership in the House and the Senate this year?
You know, I would say that assessment is probably partially correct. I think that's probably part of it. I mean, I will say it came up fast at the end of session. It was not something that we had talked about. That particular provision of the gun bill was not something that we had talked about all the way through session and said, this is a priority for us. We must get it done. I mean, it kind of came up quick. So I can't say that he's totally wrong in that assessment. As far as accomplishments, the longer you have a supermajority or even a majority, the harder it gets to accomplish things because you accomplish things along the way. And so there are so many things that if you look back 10 years ago that we've done, it's harder to find those things. Okay, what do we got to do now? What are we going to do now? You know, and for me, it should be focusing on the nuts and bolts of government, making sure that the government operates efficiently and smoothly. For others in their districts, it probably is finding those issues that get people riled up and saying, hey, we passed something.
So are there examples of things that you would point to in this year's session that you consider really, really good accomplishments?
Yeah, I mean, not to toot my own horn here, but, you know, I passed a bill that had to do with victims of domestic violence and portability of their cell phone, which is something that's it's not a super, you know, big issue that everybody's talking about. But if you're a victim of domestic violence and your phone is on a shared plan and you are not the top person on that plan, that was a contract, and that person in effect has control of your number. So we heard from victims who were trying to break away, who couldn't take their number with them, and that causes all kinds of problems when it comes to communication with family and so forth. So the fact that we were able to get that done, I think, is a good government type of thing that we should be focusing on. You know, there are other things that I think we should be talking more about that we aren't, but.
Ellie Moxley, one of your recent stories, together with our colleague Dan Margulies, was examining particular aspects of the Republican gubernatorial debate and examining some of the claims that those candidates were making about Medicaid reform and expansion in Missouri. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I guess I wonder what questions that raises for you of the down-ballot Republican candidates like Ryan Silvey.
Sure. Our health editor, Dan Margulies, the day after our colleagues over at St. Louis Public Radio hosted the gubernatorial debate last week, he came in and said, you know, there were some things said about Medicaid expansion that I just don't think line up with conventional wisdom on kind of the facts about the Affordable Care Act and kind of where the debate stands in Missouri. So we set out to kind of check some of the claims from the candidates, and all of the Republican candidates are saying no Medicaid expansion. I mean, do you think that kind of squares with the attitude right now in Jeff City? Or do you think maybe now that we're starting to maybe see some of these, you know, the hospitals continue to lobby very strongly for Medicaid expansion. Where do you kind of see that going in the next session?
You know, it's going to be interesting to kind of go full circle to something that was said earlier. You mentioned that Governor Pence is now being a vice presidential candidate. It'll be fascinating for me if he is, because he expanded Medicaid in Indiana. And the plan that I put forth was actually more conservative than his plan. And yet, when we had that debate here, you know, I was assailed for that. And so if now the vice presidential candidate is a governor who did it, I'm very interested to see how my colleagues react to that and whether that changes the debate.
Does it disappoint you that none of the four candidates for governor from your party would support an expansion of Medicaid?
You know, it does, in that the only way that you're going to get reform is to get a waiver, and the only way that you're going to get a waiver is to do some sort of eligibility reform, which would, you know, people call expansion. I think for their purposes right now, because they're all running in a primary and because there is a presidential election, I think they're all holding out hope that if they win, that a Republican gets in the White House and then the issue goes away and they don't ever have to deal with it. That's my personal take. It'll be very, very interesting if we elect a Republican governor and that's not the scenario, and we continue to have to figure out how to deal with the ACA as it moves down the road.
The four candidates for the Republican nomination for governor have some very different personalities, some very different backgrounds, in some ways not a lot of differences in policy positions. Have you expressed a preference among those four candidates?
No, I haven't, actually.
Would you like to do that here today?
Not a chance.
I mean, what's
I know them all personally.
Yeah.
With the exception of Greitens, I don't know very well. Bruner, I know from his last run for Senate a little bit. Catherine, I've known for years. Peter, I've known for years. So I'll just see what the voters have to say.
Well, I guess let me ask you this: What do you think you would advise your fellow Republican voters to be thinking about as they step into the booth and cast a vote for governor?
You know, I would try to decide for myself who I think has the skill set to be the best governor. I think too often we get wrapped up in sound bites and emotional issues, and we have this whole culture right now of the outsider versus the politician. You know, when you look at the outsiders that have been elected to governor over the last several years in most states, they don't typically tend to be very good governors. I mean, so I would just say when you're going to cast your vote, figure out who you think would actually do the best job, not who's necessarily run the best campaign.
The only candidate who hasn't in some way tried to present him or herself as an outsider is Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder, I think.
It's pretty hard to be an outsider when you're the lieutenant governor.
Exactly.
Like, governor's already in your title.
And, of course, Catherine Hanaway is a former Speaker of the House, but she hasn't been in office for more than a decade.
Right. Well, she was a U.S. attorney, too.
Right.
Presidential appointee.
Right. Eric Greitens has never held office. John Bruner hasn't either. They are presenting themselves all as, to some degree or other, outsiders. You're suggesting that that isn't what voters should be looking for.
Well, I mean, I guess... You know, lightning strikes once in a while, and maybe somebody who's never done any political job before would do a great job at the top political job in a state, but the odds are probably against that.
All right. And I guess one last sort of question about that. Would you support any of the four candidates if they're the Republican nominee over Chris Koster, the likely Democratic nominee?
You know, I'm going to support the Republican ticket in Missouri.
All right. There you go. On that.
You know, I guess one of the things I'm wondering is, you know, as there are many Republicans who I feel like don't feel like Donald Trump represents their interests and represents maybe the Republican Party they've supported, are there any conversations that are being had about kind of what effect that could have on down ballot races? And, you know, kind of what are you looking at or what are you hearing from folks when they're maybe concerned about kind of what's next and how all this plays out in Missouri?
Yeah, you know, fortunately, Missourians tend to be, when they go into the ballot box, they don't tend to be focused on one party or the other, or coattails don't seem to be very long in Missouri, I guess would be a good way to put that. So as far as I'm concerned and being on the ballot and the Donald Trump effect and the concerns that some people have, it doesn't really bother me at all. You know, it's my job to convince voters to support me. And with the elimination of straight ticket voting back in 2006, that allows every candidate to make the case to the voter. If they get all the way down the ballot and they look at my name, they're making a choice based on me, not necessarily based on who's above me. So I'm not terribly concerned about down ballot effects.
You think that Missouri voters have shown a propensity for being willing to split their ticket anyway?
Sure. I mean, if you look at in my past races, Jay Nixon has gotten the vote in my district to be governor. I've gotten the vote to be representative or senator. So people bounce back and forth.
Let's talk about your race then, if we can, just a little bit. As we mentioned, you don't have a Republican opponent in the primary, but you are facing one Democratic candidate in November, Randon Bechtold, who I think I'm characterizing this accurately would probably not have been seen as a likely victor in a head-to-head battle with you as an incumbent senator. Except that he received a very large $25,000 donation from an anti-labor Republican donor who wants you out. He's a Republican, but he's targeting Republicans who
right.
Voted against right to work or voted to sustain the governor's veto.
Right.
I guess I'm curious about your reaction to that. You face a battle that, and it's an internecine conflict.
Yeah, you know, it was a little disappointing. Of course, I was glad not to have a primary, but to have a Republican conservative mega donor give money to my Democrat opponent because of one vote that I cast was pretty disappointing and eye-opening. At the same time that some people, you know, will be so driven to throw $25,000 at a person that they've probably never met. I hadn't met him till yesterday.
Oh, you did meet him yesterday.
Yeah, he was at a forum that I was at yesterday. But you know, I don't know that I'm that concerned about it. I think honestly, just from what I've seen, the fact that money went to him has probably hurt him more than it's helped him, because I think other traditional Democrats are like, whoa, what are you? Who is this guy and why is he taking this money? You know, we do our quarterly reports to the Ethics Commission and his quarterly report that he turned in on the 9th, that is the only itemized contributor to his campaign is David Humphreys. Hmm. He has no other contributors. So it doesn't look like it's having a helpful effect for him.
I want to ask you, looking forward, if you should be reelected and are serving 2017, give us a kind of a very early preview. What would you see as the kind of legislative agenda that you would like to see what will presumably be a Republican majority put out on the floor next year?
You know, I think we need to have a very serious conversation about transportation funding in this state, and not just from a funding standpoint of how do we increase revenue to transportation, but what is our responsibility to the existing road system, and is the existing road system appropriate? I think we always talk about the one side of the ledger of we need to raise more taxes. We've put tax increases on the ballot. The voters have rejected them. We never look at the other side of the balance sheet, which is what are we actually paying for? And when you look at surrounding states, they have way less miles per capita. They have way less miles for their geography than we do. I mean, we have 33,000 miles under state maintenance. That's ridiculous when you look at it. And so I think we need to start figuring out what should our state transportation system look like and make it look that way, in addition to how do we put more revenue into it.
One more question from my KCUR colleague, Ellie Moxley.
I think that, there's an environment in Missouri right now. I mean, I think the governor's race at this point is anybody's guess what will happen. Let's say you end up with a Republican governor and Republican majorities in both houses. Do you think your colleagues are going to be looking at what's going on in Kansas and the budget crisis there and maybe, considering kind of that backlash as you move forward in a majority situation?
I would hope so, but if we are returned with supermajorities and a Republican governor, I don't have a high level of confidence that they won't move down that road anyway. I think there are a number of things that could potentially happen, and even happen over the objections of a filibuster in that situation.
All right. So something to look forward to in the 2017 legislative season. KCUR's Ellie Moxley, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Brian.
And State Senator Ryan Silvey, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you again for having me.
And as always, I'm sure you've been preparing for this, perhaps consulting with your 10-year-old daughter, Callie. We need you to choose our closing song for the show today.
So we did not consult Callie and I about this, but I did think about it. And as a fan of cover songs, I would like The Ghost of Tom Joad as played by Rage Against the Machine.
The Ghost of Tom Joad as played by Rage Against the Machine sounds like a winner to me. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, thank you.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can find us on iTunes or on kcur.org/statehouseblend. Follow us on Twitter. It's a good way to keep up on the show and on the news from Jeff City and Topeka and all sorts of politics these days. I'm at PTS Brian. You can follow my co-host Sam Zeff at Sam Zeff, and we use the hashtag Statehouse Blend. You can find a shorter version of us on the air every Tuesday morning on Up to Date. That's at 11 a.m. on KCUR 89.3. And if you have any other thoughts or to be on the show as a citizen guest, shoot me an email. I'm at Brian at kcur.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.